From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. For many people, the word famine conjures images of the great Ethiopian famine in the 1980s. But famines haven't been relegated to the dust heap of history. In fact, the United Nations says that the world is facing the worst food crisis since World War II. 20 million people are at risk of starvation right now in four countries. On today's Global Journalist, we're going to focus on two of these. Up first is South Sudan. The East African nation became independent from Sudan in 2011 after decades of horrific civil war. One of the poorest and least developed places on earth, independence for the oil-producing nation has not made life better for most of the population. That's because a new civil war has engulfed the country. Ethnic violence has splintered South Sudan's U.S.-backed government into warring factions. According to the UN, 7.5 million people, or two-thirds of the entire population, are in need of humanitarian aid. In February, the UN declared a famine in parts of the country, the first time it's issued such a declaration in 6 years. Joining us first to talk about the crisis in South Sudan is Sam Mednick. She's a journalist in the capital, Juba, where she's written for outlets including the Associated Press. Sam, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you very much for having me, Jason. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Sam, as I mentioned, you're in the capital, Juba. There was fighting between some different factions earlier last year. What's it like in the capital right now?
Right now, there's a serene sense of calm. I would say a surreal sense of calm. It feels quite okay. There's less looting. The government's cracked down on petty theft. There's still things that go off every now and then. A couple nights ago, there was gunshots, but it was just a drunken soldier. So I would say, in general, it's fairly calm, much better than it was in July and August.
And at that time, there was actually an attack by South Sudanese forces on foreign aid workers. Isn't that right?
Exactly. So in July, there was an attack for a couple of days. I wasn't here at that point, but that's when fighting erupted again in Juba, and it lasted for several days. There were attacks on aid workers in one of the main compounds, Terrain, which was horrific, and attacks around the city, which then escalated through the rest of the country, and that was sort of the second wave of attacks. And then since then, it's died down a bit, but there's still pockets of fighting and fighting throughout the rest of the country.
And people often think of famines as being caused by drought, but that doesn't sound like that's exactly the situation right now in South Sudan. Tell us just a little bit about why so many people are dying there from food shortages.
Well, yes, when they declared the famine, they said that this was a man-made famine. And in essence, it is, because people haven't been able to cultivate their crops. What the fighting does is it causes populations to shift. And so people are constantly moving around. They can't cultivate. They can't grow crops. And so therefore, they're not eating. There's incredible insecurity, food insecurity, as well as just stability. People are afraid to come back to their homes. They're hiding in swamps. They're just dispersed. So they're not able to make food, and as such, a famine has resulted. It's so hard for people to get the food to those who need it, so there's access problems as well. So many people are starving. There's food that we're trying to get to them, but they can't be accessed.
And in some places, I should say, there's actually been scenes of the UN airdropping food into areas that are so remote or so difficult to get to that they're literally like pushing food out of airplanes. But I wanted to ask you just to give us a brief overview of who it is that's exactly fighting and what are they fighting for such that it has led to a crisis of such enormous proportion.
I mean, it's a loaded question, and I think probably many people would have different answers to that question. I think in a nutshell, government forces and the opposition are fighting. Now, the opposition is now several different factions. There's breakaway opposition factions. So it would be Kiir's forces against Machar, but then there's breakaway forces off of Machar. And it's everything from the economic
crisis.
And
I'm sorry, Kiir is President Salva Kiir, and Machar was his former vice president. They're from different ethnic groups.
Right, sorry. So Kiir is from the Dinka group, right, and Machar is from the Nuer, but he is no longer the vice president. He's been exiled, and he's no longer in the country. However, if you speak to some of the opposition forces, they will tell you they're getting their directives directly from Machar. So, and then there's break-off groups, like I mentioned, and there's the ethnic divide, there's also the economic crisis, there's also the need for control. I would say those are a mix of factors that play into the reasons for why the fighting's happening.
And I understand that you recently made a boat trip with some aid workers who are trying to help people forced from their homes by the fighting. Tell us just a little bit about that.
So I was with Oxfam, an NGO who was trying to combat a cholera outbreak in Ganyel, which is in Unity province, because it's unprecedented that there's a cholera outbreak in dry season. And they were heading to this island that's only accessible by boat. So this is a canoe made out of a coconut. It's very narrow. You're canoeing through swampy waters for about 2.5 hours each way to go to this island where there's 2,300 people right now on the island, which there used to be, just to put in perspective, 200 before this. There's no toilet. There's no clean water. And so the cholera outbreak is really manifesting. It's breeding on this island. And so they went to see what they could do. They didn't have any of their supplies because access to their supplies was hard. So they pretty much went to give an information session about best sanitation practices. I mean, you have 2,300 people living in filth, and it's heartbreaking.
And tell us just a little bit about some of the stories of the people that you met there. Why is it that people are sort of fleeing into these swamps in South Sudan? How do they live there?
So when fighting breaks out, like I said earlier, the population shift. I mean, one woman I spoke to she fled fighting in Bentu, which was another town. She spent 10 days in a boat with her children. Her husband, she didn't know where he was. They're eating water lilies, eating whatever they could get from the water. They landed on Tayer, this island. And she said, look, they gave me land. I want to stay here. Since then, you know, one of her children had cholera, was just recovering from cholera. They're living in squalor. They're pretty much defecating where they're cooking. They're drawing from the same waters, to cook, where they're going to the bathroom. And so it's just continuing this outbreak.
And tell us, if you would, about the government of South Sudan. This is a government that was, effectively put in place with a great amount of aid from the United States. How effective have they been in cooperating with international aid forces? What's it like to be a reporter there?
Well, so I'd say it's a two-pronged question. I mean, the United States has been, they contributed over $2 billion, I think, since 2013. So they are a huge contributor to what's going on here. And they're a big donor and are doing a lot of really great work. Being a reporter here is difficult for everybody. They're cracking down a lot. There have been reports, you might have heard, that they're not even letting journalists into the country. I just had to renew my press pass recently, and they had all of my articles printed up that I'd written and kind of were assessing me to see if it was okay if I was writing good enough things to stay in the country. So it's very much a dictatorship. They're censoring what you write. Local journalists are put in jail all the time. It's tough being a reporter here.
Well, Sam Mednick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're talking today about what the UN says is the worst food crisis since World War II. 20 million people are at risk of starvation right now in South Sudan, Nigeria, Somalia, and Yemen. We just heard about South Sudan from reporter Sam Mednick. We're going to expand our discussion now to include the nearby East African nation of Somalia. Now, back in 2011, 250,000 people died in Somalia in its last famine. 6 years later, famine is on the brink of returning to a country that, like South Sudan, is in the midst of conflict. Joining us to talk more about this from Washington, D.C. is Scott Paul. He's a senior humanitarian advisor at the aid group Oxfam America. Also joining us in Washington is Kimberly Flowers. She's the director of the Global Food Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And in Rome, Italy, is Letitia Bader. She's a researcher on Somalia and East Africa for Human Rights Watch. Welcome to all of you. Kimberly Flowers, let me start with you. We just heard Sam Mednick talking about some of the difficulties for journalists and for aid groups working in South Sudan. Before we turn this to Somalia, what can you tell us about what you've heard, what you understand is happening there?
Well, it's interesting, Jason, that yesterday there was a U.S. congressional briefing on the state of global humanitarian affairs, and in that it was brought up that in South Sudan, humanitarian workers are now being charged $10,000 for a visa, which is obviously outrageous and even adds more to the lack of access. We also know that humanitarian convoys continue to be attacked and that there are a number of violations of war crimes. We also were hearing that girls and women are being forced to trade sex for food. So I think a lot of things are coming out, both in these congressional briefings and in the mainstream media, that are appalling, and we absolutely have to do something quickly to remedy this.
Well, let me turn this to Letitia Bader. I understand that you were recently in Somalia for Human Rights Watch and met some people affected in that country by sort of the hunger crisis that's happening there now. What sorts of stories did you hear while you were on the ground?
So I traveled both to Mogadishu and also to Baidoa, which is very much the epicenter of the crisis right now. And I spoke to many people who are newly displaced. We already have in Somalia about 1.1 million people who are displaced, who can't go back to their homes because of insecurity, because the armed Islamic group Al-Shabaab is controlling the areas. And now we once again have massive tens of thousands of people who are newly displaced. So I spoke to some of them in Baidoa, and the stories we hear, I mean, a lot of these are communities which were just starting to come together again to reestablish themselves and to deal with the consequences of the last famine, and suddenly they've been hit again by a series of seasons without rain. So I spoke to one man, for example, who has lost about 40 cattle in the last 4 months. Then he said to me, you know, I still had some sorghum, so I could still feed my children. But then that he lost that as well. And so he had walked kilometers and kilometers with his whole family to the town of Baidoa. Now, Baidoa is incredibly poor. It's still very unsafe. And although there is a certain level of international presence in Baidoa, it's not a town where you have massive humanitarian access. So a lot of these people are actually just moving into informal displacement camps, which are not protected and which are not for the moment particularly well serviced either. So going from a terrible situation to very much one of insecurity and in some cases of lack of assistance as well.
And Scott Paul, your organization responded to the last famine in Somalia in 2011 when, as I mentioned, 250,000 people died. Tell us just a little bit about how the situation there now compares with what happened 6 years ago.
Well, 6 years ago, what happened in large part was warnings were issued, and then essentially the international community, it didn't really register with the international community that a famine was possible until after it happened. It really didn't break through the public consciousness. And at that point, again, in the south and central of the country where people were being hit hardest, it was really, really difficult to negotiate with all of the different parties and also get the legal clearance from the U.S. government to go into areas that were hardest hit. This is a slightly different situation in that we've also had warnings, but people at this point have tried to respond earlier. Government donors have tried to respond earlier. International organizations haven't waited for the worst case to materialize. They've gone in, and they've done these sort of no-regrets programs to try to get out ahead of what might be the worst problems. The problem is, from a climactic point of view, it's even more difficult. We've now had a number of successive failed rains, partly because of the El Niño phenomenon. And as a result, the areas that are being hit hardest aren't all the same areas that were hit in the famine of 2011 and 2012. And you have areas like if you picture Somalia as like an elbow, right in the crook of that elbow in the northeastern part of the country, are provinces like Sol and Seneg that are chronically underdeveloped, really really poor, but didn't experience the worst of these problems. And when I and my colleagues went to the north of the country just a month and a half ago, we saw the kinds of manifestations of pre-famine conditions that were really concerning. So now the question is, since we do know it's happening, since we are relatively sensitized to it, can we mobilize fast enough to prevent the worst-case scenario?
And Kimberly Flowers, if I could turn this back to you, we heard Scott Paul talking about how in 2011 there was a famine in Somalia and that just didn't sort of break through into the international community such that there wasn't an effective response. And I'm interested in sort of the trajectory of international responses to these crises in East Africa. Now, when many of us were growing up in the 1980s, there was this enormous effort led by pop stars, by Bob Geldof and Harry Belafonte and Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie. And there was this album, We Are the World, that generated huge awareness of the famine in East Africa. And then even back in the early 1990s, we had the U.S. Marines actually undertaking a military operation in Somalia to alleviate a famine. So why aren't we seeing similar sorts of responses now?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, one is to go back to a point that Sam made about, you know, that the famines are man-made. And it's important to keep in mind that famines are not the result of food scarcity, but really a result of failed democracy. And it's also important to think about the connections between conflict and hunger. And so, you know, ultimately, no matter what kind of international humanitarian response, even if it responded well, these kinds of protracted crises are going to continue as long as there's weak governance and conflicts that kind of exacerbate these sort of issues and resource constraints on food systems that are already there. Another thing to think about in terms of the international response is simply that we are in unprecedented times right now. What's happening in terms of the magnitude, the severity, and the geographic scope of this emergency food insecurity is unprecedented at the same time as we're seeing more displaced persons than ever before. So the people's budgets are just strapped, and there isn't enough funding out there and the kind of political will that is needed to respond to this. In terms of the U.S. government, at least, as you well know, we're in a we have a lot of competing political priorities, and we're in a very different sort of political landscape than we've been before. And unfortunately, this current administration doesn't quite see the linkages between why investing overseas really relates back to global stability and our national security interests. That's something that I tried to advocate for quite loudly and that I will continue to do.
Well, and I think the U.S. Policy going forward is something that we want to come back to. But let me go back to you, Letitia Bader, because there's a lot of description of the general security situation in Somalia and sort of the difficulties of getting aid to the people that need it. And I understand that actually hundreds of thousands of people who need aid are actually in fairly urban areas in Somalia. So why is it that the Somali government, that the international community, can't get the food to the people that need it?
Well, one of the big problems is that over the last 2 years in particular, we've seen massive forced evictions of those who are displaced. So in 2011 to about 2013, if we just take the capital, Mogadishu.
So wait, you said people that are already displaced. So these are people who are already like have been forced from their homes and they're kind of like camped out in a internal refugee camp. And then you're saying they're being forced out of these internal refugee camps.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Mogadishu was all over Mogadishu. You had these very informal camps. So basically people who had put up little huts with sticks, etc., when they fled the 2011 famine. And then over the last 2 years, they've been pushed off this land. And so they're being pushed more and more to the outskirts of the urban areas. Now, I mean, I think it's important to highlight that even though there is government control over the centers of quite a few of the big towns in south central Somalia now, on the outskirts, often you have the armed Islamist group Al-Shabaab. So talking about Mogadishu again, what we've been seeing is tens of thousands of individuals who fled the famine in 2011, who cannot go back to their homes because it's not safe and because of the humanitarian crisis, who right now are being pushed on the outskirts of town where it's not safe for humanitarian actors to move. And at the same time, it obviously puts these communities in incredibly vulnerable situations where they are at risk of sexual violence. I mean, we've continued to document incredibly high rates of sexual violence against those who are internally displaced in urban areas throughout the country. And you know, one of the big issues with the government is that while the government acknowledged that they needed to start improving the conditions of internally displaced people in their towns, they haven't really done anything about it. And if anything, it's often been police and government actors which have been involved in violently, forcibly evicting people to parts of the towns, to the outskirts, where they were not going to get basic assistance and protection. So this is one thing which the new government absolutely needs to focus on, is making sure that at a minimum, they are not contributing to putting these very vulnerable communities in even more vulnerable situations.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Global Journalist. We're talking today about the food crisis this year in South Sudan and Somalia that may already have killed tens of thousands of people, many of them children. We're joined by Scott Paul of Oxfam America, Kimberly Flowers of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Letitia Bader of Human Rights Watch. Scott Paul, let me turn this back to you, because from the outside, it does seem like Somalia has basically had no government for a quarter of a century. And we just heard Letitia Bader talking about how, in some cases, the government seems to be exacerbating the situation, the humanitarian situation, by forcing people who are already displaced off their own land. What's your read on this as someone who works for one of the major aid organizations?
Well, I turn this back, actually, to something that Kimberly said, which is that when there's some misconceptions about famine, and one of them is that famine results from food shortage. Governance problems and specifically lack of representation, lack of inclusion of key stakeholders, and lack of responsiveness to the most vulnerable groups tend to be some of the key drivers of famine. In Somalia, the governance in Somalia is incredibly fragmented. I think it's important for listeners to bear that in mind. You've got a federal government that's worked over the past 5 years or so to strengthen its hold on power, to build its legitimacy, but also to build a federal system of government. And so you have a number of these sort of regional governments that have come up, and themselves have a part to play in either helping or helping people or exacerbating the conflict and the food crisis. And then in the north, you've got the government of Somaliland, which has claimed independence as an autonomous and independent republic, but isn't recognized. So the governance situation is very complex. But just to go back to that misconception, you know, the other misconception, apart from famine being about food shortage, is that to solve famine, we just need to get food from here to there. Uh-huh. I don't know if you've seen this recently, but there's been a really interesting and inspiring Twitter campaign to get Turkish Airlines to fly a plane to Somalia and then fill that plane with food and other goods that are essential. And I really, really hope we can sort of take that energy and channel it towards some of the problems that are really driving this food crisis. For example, you know, can we make sure that markets are open for Somali livestock and camels? There's been some problems on that front recently. Can we make sure that flows from Somali members of the Somali diaspora, remittance flows, are able to continue to flow? Since Somali members of the Somali diaspora actually send more money to Somalia than Somalia receives in humanitarian assistance.
Sure, and these are Somalis living in places like Minnesota or London.
Not international organizations, but local organizations that are on the ground and working to meet needs. Those are some of the questions I think we can start to ask if we reconceptualize famine as being something other than just a food shortage.
Well, let me turn this back to you, Kimberly Flowers, then. Is part of the problem in the international response simply fatigue, perhaps, with crises in this part of the world? I mean, Somalia has been through a number of different iterations of governments over the past 25 years. Correct me if I'm wrong. I understand the new president had to be inaugurated at the airport because that was the only place where they could have security for him here. I mean, you were in Ethiopia, I understand, for a number of years. Every year, even in a good year, you have tens of thousands of children under five dying of malnutrition. So is part of the issue just that there is sort of a hopelessness on the part of the international community in its ability to resolve these problems?
I don't think it's hopelessness. I think it goes back to what Scott said, is just misunderstandings. One thing I want to bring up, both with Scott talking about governance and since you mentioned Ethiopia, is, you know, when you look back at the famines that we grew up with, in the sense of thinking of the Ethiopian famine and the Band-Aid and all the big rock stars that came out for that, you know, look at Ethiopia now. Far from perfect, don't get me wrong, including on the democratic front, but it's suffering its worst drought in 50 years, and there are still 10 million people who are in food aid, but it's not headed towards famine. And the reason for that is because of its safety net program and because of the significant progress and development gains it has had there, and its government's willingness and attention and funding towards productive safety net programs to protect weak and vulnerable people to respond to shocks. Again, still a serious issue there, but it's a different situation because because of its governance structure, whereas in Somalia, you simply don't have that. I think in terms of the international community, I spent yesterday actually up in New York at the United Nations in a workshop talking about hunger and conflict and heard from a number of member states and UN agencies. And certainly there is a level of hopelessness in the sense of this is heartbreaking because famines are predictable, famines are preventable, and very much we want to put our attention and raise awareness for this and do what we know can be done to turn this around. But the bottom line is that funding is stretched because we really, again, are in unprecedented times. And I think a lot of policymakers simply don't understand the situation because they haven't spent time overseas and they haven't spent time understanding how what happens over there relates back to global stability as a whole.
And Letitia Bader, let me turn this to you then to touch on something that Kimberly Flowers mentioned earlier, and that is that the new administration in the United States has taken a different approach to foreign aid. President Trump has proposed some rather significant cuts to the U.S. aid budget, which would be sort of the main agency responding to crises like this. How does this sort of America First agenda fit with responding to crises in places like Somalia and South Sudan?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is one of the concerns we've had is that some of the budgets which have been cut have been very much the ones which have been used in the past to step in when there have been emergencies of this sort. I mean, I do think it is important in the Somalia context to highlight something Scott said earlier, that in the past, U.S. assistance, and I would say U.S. policies and laws around where that assistance ended up made humanitarian work in Somalia particularly complicated, especially in al-Shabaab areas. And I think this remains one of the concerns of the humanitarian community as they beef up their response right now. But there's obviously a different dynamic also in terms, and I think this is more of a political question as well, has been the freezing of resettlement. You know, one of our big concerns at the moment is obviously that for Somalis that need to flee their homes right now, moving into neighboring countries is absolutely a critical form of protection and survival. And in 2011, tens of thousands of people actually fled into Kenya. Now, Kenya has said that it is closing its main refugee camp, which is host to about 270,000 Somalis. And, you know, one of the issues which the international community has responded and has been trying to call on Kenya to make sure that they are still offering haven to Somalis who need to flee. But obviously, to a certain extent, that sounds pretty hypocritical at a time where the U.S. has closed its resettlement of Somalis to the US. And so I think this also plays into geopolitical dynamics, which once again place Somalis in a very difficult situation where the options on the table to them for them right now are very small.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Sam Mednick, Scott Paul, Kim Flowers, and Letitia Bader for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Lauren Donovan, Idom Kasaye, and Dewey Sim, with supervising producer Rachel Foster Gimbel. Alyssa Blyle is visual editor with assistance from Jonah McCown and Hannah Sandfeld. Kyle Felling is our audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.